Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Welcome, everybody, to the second to the last contemporary issues for the program year. So we will have one more next week, and it will still be a surprise topic. I have still like three different topics kicking around that I could do something with, but I'm having trouble finding the right resource to sort of share with us so that we're just sort of bringing lacks of knowledge together. So try to get a little bit of knowledge in the room to talk about one of these other, as you are aware, if you follow any contemporary current events, you know that there's plenty kicking around. So I'm going to try to be not super contemporary, but contemporary enough that it's still relevant. So be surprised next week. This week, I'm going to talk about praying for liberation. That's what my first sign says. So we're going to, I'm going to tell you about, and then we'll just sort of have some conversation about a vigil that I participate in every Monday noon. So I was just down there again today. So I'll give kind of a narrative and some reflections, and then we'll have conversation together. So I need to start with three disclaimers for you. The first disclaimer is that I'm going to be talking about policing this evening, and I am not in any way, shape, or form an expert on policing. So there's one. The second disclaimer is this is even more a mea culpa than a disclaimer. I'm praying about policing. I'm not working with any police departments. So there are other ways of engaging that are also very relevant. And I am not engaged in all the different ways one could be. So I'm going to try to talk about the specific way I am engaged. And the third disclaimer, and I want to be real clear about this, policing is an institution and sort of a cultural concept. It's a thing that happens, an activity. And then there are police officers who are human beings. And when I talk about policing or police officers, I want to be clear which of those things I'm talking about. And for the most part, I'm going to be talking about policing as an activity that is carried out on behalf of in this case, local and state government. So I just want to be clear that there are pieces of this that are personal in terms of the effects that it has on people, including the effects that the effect of policing on police officers. I think we need to be sensitive to that as well. And the police officers that I know and have known, man, they're in it because they want to serve and protect and care for people. So both of those things can be true. So I started last year going down to the Des Moines Police Department headquarters every Monday noon. And I started doing that because I have been working on actually physically showing up for things that matter. And there are, you know, there are other contexts in which as well, I try to, you know, put my person there and not just sort of my words. In early July of last year, some of my clergy colleagues began holding this vigil outside the Des Moines Police Department every day at noon, every weekday. And these same pastors had been active in the protests after the murder of George Floyd at the end of May last year in Minneapolis. And these colleagues were mostly white. And so they were showing up in solidarity with the Des Moines Black Liberation Movement, which at the time was known as Black Lives Matter. They've kept the initials, adjusted the words. So now they're the Black Liberation Movement. We all, I'm sure, saw those protests on TV nightly, right? Involving, you know, broken windows at retail buildings and government buildings, included the use of tear gas and pepper spray and arrests of sizable numbers of protesters. And those protests also included some specific, really assertive demands from the Black Liberation Movement. So including, for instance, the restoration of voting rights for people who had completed prison sentences for felonies, an ordinance against racial profiling in police practice, and several others. So during the month of July, I had, this was during the month of June, actually, I had been part of a letter on behalf of faith leaders across Iowa joining BLM's call for the voting rights restoration executive order. And I got to signing that letter after I had spent all last legislative session contacting legislators and asking them to please pass the constitutional amendment to restore voting rights for people who had finished felony sentences. The president of the Senate emailed me and said, yes, I support this and we're bringing it to a vote. And then he gaveled out the session. That Senate president is no longer Senate president. He retired. That's a different story. But I helped to draft and sign this letter joining that call for a voting rights executive order and helped deliver that to Governor Reynolds' office. So that was one of those moments of showing up physically. The next day, after we had been down there at the Capitol, one of my colleagues was at the Capitol with Black Lives Matter for a protest. And as the protesters arrived at the Capitol, the Iowa State Patrol, who has original jurisdiction for things that happen in the Capitol, and the Des Moines Police Department began arresting protesters based on intelligence about an earlier protest at which protesters had vandalized a Des Moines police car. So when that took place, one of my colleagues posted on Facebook the need for just clergy bodies to be at the Capitol ASAP to defuse this situation that had sort of exploded as soon as protesters showed up. And so I went to the Capitol. I grabbed my stole, I went down to the Capitol, and when I got there, I found that the arrest activity had finished, and so I was redirected out to the Polk County Jail, where I spent time really just waiting, standing vigil, even at that point, with the crowd in the designated protest area in the jail parking lot, waiting for the folks who had been arrested to arrive and then eventually to be bailed out. Protesters from those incidents at the Capitol faced numerous charges, including assault on officers. And because they were arrested at the Capitol, they were barred from going back to the Capitol for any future protests, for anything at all. They were barred from the Capitol grounds because they had been arrested on the Capitol grounds. Now, I want to be clear about the sort of the territory of that situation. Damage a police car is a crime. Protesters were aggressive toward police at some of these protests, including at the Capitol. And protesters were arrested immediately upon their entry into the Capitol building. And selectively, based on these information sheets with photos from the previous protest. Protesters were singled out of the crowd to be immediately arrested upon their arrival at the Capitol. And if you start arresting people as soon as they arrive for a protest, I'm not sure how else you expect that encounter to go. Now, I want to say that again without badmouthing the usual officers involved who presumably were following orders. Now, someone in that chain of command made the decision that that would be a good thing to do. The majority, I'm thinking, of those officers were given assignment. And in my estimation, I am not an expert on policing, in my estimation, those orders put those officers in danger. Because it put the officers in a position where they were told to escalate this situation that had not otherwise escalated. So this was the beginning of July last year. And it appeared to me really clearly by that point that that police operations were actively targeting BLM leaders. And as in that situation at the Capitol, tactically escalating situations for whatever reason, perhaps to provoke chargeable offenses. They certainly resulted in chargeable offenses, such as assault. So it was following that incident that my colleagues began this vigil. And they called the vigil "Tell the Truth." So the hashtag demand of Des Moines Police Department was, we want you, the police department, as an institution, to tell the truth about how you have been handling these protests. And the mode of this vigil was to stand outside Des Moines Police Department every day at noon. Making that assertion that that as an institution, DMPD was not telling the truth about how they had handled these protests and handled these arrests of BLM organizers and some of these organizers on progressively higher bail charges. So there was more and more cash at stake in terms of getting these folks back out of jail. Arrests of regular protesters who, this was the case for my colleagues, they were ordered to disperse and then were unable to disperse because of where the headlined themselves up. This is a well-known technique called kettling. I was not there. I can't sort of, you know, make arguments as to facts and evidence of that happening. But I have heard from enough different people at enough different places in these protests that, boy, something a whole lot like that did happen. It has, even just in the past few weeks, come to light that the Des Moines Police Department did not, at the beginning of last summer, have a crowd control policy. So they did not have policies in place for handling protests of the size that took place last summer. And so, of course, the protest response didn't go smoothly. And we know, because we've all been part of institutions, that when things go badly, institutions cover themselves. So my colleagues began this vigil, and I didn't join. I didn't go down to join this vigil because I'm picky about what truth claims I'm going to co-sign. And I didn't go down and join this vigil because I'm sort of naturally disposed to being the moderate voice in the room and seeking, you know, mutual solutions and, hey, let's just all, you know, work together and hear both sides and all that jazz, right? And so I wrote to Des Moines officials sort of to, with my voice, but not my body, stand alongside here and say, hey, this is what I'm hearing. It would be great if you could give us some other kind of evidence to counter these claims. At the end of July, another colleague was arrested. And I have no comment on the charges against this particular colleague, but those charges have since been dropped. There are lots of other charges from last summer that were also finally dropped round about this March into April. And so that tells me that there were a whole lot of arrests and a whole lot of charges filed that weren't ultimately prosecutable. Now, prosecutors have discretion. I can't comment again on the particular facts of those charges, but boy, that's a lot of charges to drop after having made a lot of arrests. Now, it is also not lost on me that it was a white person's arrest that finally got me down to the vigil line. And so there were lots of people much more sort of socially vulnerable than my colleague who were also arrested and I wasn't down there. So again, another mea culpa. I finally was called there and I put together this sign, this very sign that says praying for liberation. And I didn't know how to go pray at a vigil, and standing in places holding signs is not even remotely my love language. And so I went there and I stood just silently praying the Lord's Prayer because I knew that I didn't know what to pray. But it's like Jesus says, your heavenly parent already knows what you need and then invites us to say that prayer. So I took him at his word. And I went back the next week and I've been back there basically every week since. We've missed one or two of these. I have missed one or two of these Mondays. There is at least one clergy person there every weekday. And I'm Mondays in the rotation. Often it's just me and two or three guys from the Catholic Worker House. The Catholic Workers are a very interesting little movement within Catholicism. There are also frequently some other activists. Most of them do not have active church connections. And so kind of their only contact with clergy people is this vigil, Mondays at noon. So there I am, and I'm praying. And it is important for me that I'm there to be praying. Because protest, some folks are really fantastic with protest. Some folks really express their, you know, their righteous indignation in really eloquent, powerful, even loving ways. I don't. My anger, when I express my anger, is not usually redemptive. It's not usually righteous. And that's me. That's my being in the world, right? I'm also, it's important for me to pray because healing the world is this long-term process. It's not about specific short-term political wins. Now, there are important specific short-term political things that should happen. And I think we probably all agree, at least at that level of the statement, even if we think that the specific political things that should happen are different one from another. But this vigil for me really is about making room for God to act. That's really what prayer is for me, because I don't have the answers. And as I stand there praying for liberation, I know for sure I don't have the answers to bring this about. So I pray for liberation. I have since added, let there be peace, and let justice roll down. So I'm trying to stay theological with my signs. But when I talk about liberation, the thing I'm praying, remember, is the Lord's Prayer. And, you know, we also have conversations with each other, and you know, we're not just standing there in silence. There is a place for silent vigil. This is a chatty vigil. It's okay. But when I pray the Lord's Prayer, I'm praying for what? I'm praying for God's kingdom to come on earth, right? And the Bible consistently presents God's kingdom as this upturning of the world's power structure, that the people who are in power and the people who are not in power, that the closest we can kind of picture to what the kingdom of God is that structure flipped on its head. That's not a full enough picture of what the kingdom of God is like, but it is this sort of presumptively, the world's power structures are not in line yet with the kingdom of God. And sometimes the kingdom of God looks like, you know, something up with donuts and the people who bring their dogs and the mutual support that folks are offering to each other, which has really been a beautiful thing just to see and witness and to bring that into the meditation that I'm there participating in. I'm also praying in the Lord's Prayer, I won't go through every line of it, but I'm also praying for forgiveness, which is not the same as enforcing penalties for people's actions, right? It's about, again, healing and reconciliation. And the phrase that really started catching me was, deliver us from evil. Deliver us from evil. And where that really has stuck with me is the fact that they're in sympathy for the experiences of communities of color who know policing to be a present danger in their communities. Who know policing, again, the action, to be a present danger in their communities. Okay, so when I talk about liberation, one of the important stepping stones for me on the way to that was El Salvador. It's under contract. We have to bring up El Salvador at least once every three contemporary issues classes in order to continue. If you've been to El Salvador, you have walked that historical pilgrimage, right? The history of the war in El Salvador, which was about state repression of local communities. And that repression included direct targeted violence by the police. And that pilgrimage also includes a reckoning with instruments of the United States government. So the weapons in the museum at Perkin, the history of our involvement in repressing the people of El Salvador in the name of opposing communism. And I will also acknowledge, you know, war is war, right? So when we do that historical pilgrimage, we also recognize that there was, there was awfulness and brutality on both sides. And yet, it is really hard for me to miss that the worst brutality came from the government that was backed by US supplies and training. So that history resonates with me as I stand there on the corner praying for liberation, as I notice the imbalance of power between the Des Moines Police Department and the people of color who explicitly say that they are unfairly targeted and whom the statistics back that up. This vigil is called Tell the Truth because from outside the police department, we saw a lot of opaqueness during the events of the last year. We just don't have a comment on that. And some of that is probably reasonable in terms of, ongoing cases and prosecution and so forth. And then those charges got dropped, right? NBC News actually last week had a story profiling some of the Des Moines BLM activists. And in order to get any information from the Des Moines Police Department, they had to file open record requests and expect information rather than phone calls back from the police spokesperson. That imbalance of power there and that imbalance of transparency. This also resonates with the state's response to the civil rights movement in the 1960s and the truth that has come out only in the years since then. The other parallel, of course, is in the public opinion polling, that the percentages of approvals and disapprovals and the way that that breaks down gives some validity to what was said. You know, where you are in the summer of 2020 is where you would have been in Martin Luther King's time. So I'm with a lot of that history. As I have worked on kind of discerning where I sit with this. I'm also grateful, as I look at the El Salvador parallels, I'm grateful that that I went to El Salvador years after the Civil War. So we know that there are FMLN fighters and state police who are now serving together on San Ysidro's Directiva. So we know that healing within these communities can happen. So this is a piece of keeping the issues distinct from the people. And we also know that the problems are not all solved, right? And that reminds me that a clear victory of like one side over another side, that victory is not gonna bring in the kingdom of heaven. And at the same time, history kind of tells me to look for the kingdom on the side of the people, not on the side of the state. So I'm also praying for the people who are driving by. So I've been praying for racialization. I am also praying really specifically for the people who drive by. So there are people who drive by, we're in, just east of downtown Des Moines over the noon hour, so a lot of traffic back and forth. There are people who honk and wave and raise a fist. There are lots of police officers on their way to or from work, either in their private vehicles or in police cars, sometimes one and then the other. And as they pass and I'm praying for them and I draw my attention back to praying for those individuals as they go by, some of them are driving by with eye rolls and sneers, and some of them are going by with smiles and waves. Some of them are carefully going by without any eye contact whatsoever. I'm also aware that as I am praying for all the folks who are there, I'm also aware that not everybody who's standing with me along that line is praying. Not everybody who's standing with me along that line is open to conversation. A Des Moines Police Department officer has only directly conversed with this group as they're standing there once in about 11 months now. And I wasn't there, so I didn't get to have that conversation. Occasional passersby will talk with us from either side of either, agreeing with the signs that we're holding or disagreeing with the signs that we're holding. But I'm happy to have those conversations, and the passersby are not even really my target audience. Really, it is very important to me, this being a vigil, that God is my target audience. So I'll say just briefly-ish what I'm praying for, kind of as concretely as I can figure out how to describe it. So, and these are eventual things. This is why it's a prayer thing. There are other specific tasks that could also be worked on. But eventually, I'm hoping to see in the community, ultimately neighborhoods in which policing as we know it is no longer necessary. And no longer necessary because people have what they need in order to flourish. And that includes social services to support them at the times that they're not flourishing. And I want that for neighborhoods because I can recognize the way that social goods have historically been systematically kept away from certain communities. And I would like to see, you know, those social goods and social supports flowing more freely to those communities. I also recognize that public safety and emergency response are going to be parts of human life for a very long time. So when I say ultimately, I mean way ultimately, right? And so we need public safety. We need emergency response. I wonder if it needs to be armed. I wonder if that's actually necessary in order to ensure public safety and provide emergency response. I wonder if the people providing the safety and the emergency response need to be the force in control of every situation all the time. I wonder that. That's an ultimately still. Sooner than that, man, I would love to see some real robust civilian and judicial oversight of the way that policing is carried out. I'd like to see really robust accountability where civilians have as many rights in a given situation as the officers do. I really would love to see transparency so that the community can really trust that the police department is in fact doing what it says it's doing. And, you know, kind of nuts and bolts, I'd like to see a duty incumbent on those officers of the peace, a duty to de-escalate, that their first responsibility is to dial a situation down. And I want that to be specifically incumbent on the police because, as I look at it, the people with the badges and the guns have more power than the people who don't have that positional authority. And so it seems to me that the people who can de-escalate situations are the ones with the body armor and the force of the state behind them. Because I want to see this duty de-escalate as well, because if the people with the badges and the guns can show the community that they can lower the temperature, then the people with the badges and the guns will have a lot safer job. That that their willingness to step down and de-escalate is actually something that would tend toward building trust with the community. So those are things that I am hoping to see, and things that I'm specifically praying for. There's also an issue here to you. So this is a group of clergy who have been doing this work of vigil and have started to say, okay, what's next in this work of vigil for us? The next piece actually is going to be an invitation to folks such as yourselves to come and learn and discuss. Specifically in response to some of the topics of concern that BLM has identified. The Black Liberation Movement does not identify these as topics of concern. That's my very soft language. They identify these as demands. The word demand there, I think, is carefully chosen on their part. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. So if a power structure is there and no one is making that power structure change, it won't. So that's where some of that language of demand comes from. And I'm not going to tone police that because it's my job to listen, not to make them perform according to dominant culture standards that are very Iowa nice and we don't demand things of each other. It's also not my language because part of being an ally is to amplify other people's voices. So BLM has identified these demands and we can think about these as specific topics that have been identified as issues in the relationship of particularly the Black community in Des Moines with the institution of policing. And so some of these demands include the termination of police officers with violent records. They include the legalization and decriminalization of marijuana. They include defunding and abolishing the police. And let me translate just slightly what those words mean, because those have been kind of weaponized words now. But that is to say, to make policing unnecessary, because we are solving societal problems before they get to the level that law enforcement has to deal with them. So one of the ways of describing what it would look like to defund the police is the suburbs, where we've got access to all kinds of amazing social services and institution, and access to access not only to jobs but to the social supports when things are not going well, and police interactions are much lower in the suburbs than they are in urban areas, and it maps directly onto those social supports. So that was me translating those couple of scare words, because I don't want that to be the only piece we get to talk about. So there's an invitation to actually come down Mondays at noon, or some other time at noon, if you like, and have just some topical conversations. So very similar to the kinds of conversations we have at Contemporary Issues. And they would be focused around these specific issues of structural racism in our communities. So we are beginning to invite those conversations down on that corner, bring a chair. And in the meantime, I'm gonna continue praying. Not protesting, but holding space and contemplatively calling on God to act through us. So that's what I'm up to on Mondays at noon.
I'm going to use a couple of words. So this will only take a second. Sorry, I jumped in on you. I'm going to use a couple of words that don't get used in polite Presbyterianism very much, and that is witness and testimony. And what you did is as powerful a witness and testimony as I have heard in a very long time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Warren.
Yeah, Warren.
I just had a couple of clarifications. You've been doing this through good weather and bad, and I'm curious, how long do you typically stay there on a Monday, depending on the weather, I suspect?
It depends a little on the weather. The commitment time is about a half hour, from about 12:15 to 12:45. When the weather is fine, we stay more like from noon to one, about the hour typically when the weather is nice. So today it only sprinkled just a little bit over the noon hour, and so we stuck it out all the way to one. I can only speak to Mondays, but there were a few other days of the week where this happened as well, where the in-person vigil was suspended because it was too snowy. And so folks vigiled virtually. So they would, and I did this once, you'd take a selfie of yourself with your sign and post yourself on Facebook. Every week there's also an invitation to some specific action items. So contacting the Des Moines City Council, who, as you have seen in the news, the Des Moines City Council has gotten more than their fill of BLM activists contacting them through the last 12 months. but also, you know, specific speaking out on legislation. A lot of it is advocacy type things. So speaking out about a sort of a mutual aid neighborhood fridge that ran into zoning trouble in Des Moines, but also donating to the folks who are filling that fridge, donating to the folks who are bailing people out of jail. So some of those as specific action items. So on the days when it was legit too snowy to safely get out and drive down there, and these Catholic worker guys are not young, that on those days we vigiled virtually by you know, taking one of those other advocacy steps. So I only canceled once due to weather. I think I had a scheduling conflict another time. I did go down there at like, you know, the wind chill was about 10 below. And I did it to prove that I still could, but I lived in northern Minnesota for a while, so I have things to prove. So yes, all different weather.
Just to follow up, fortunately, I've only been to the Des Moines Police Department maybe two or three times. But if I remember, the main steps are facing the west. They're on the west side of the building. And you mentioned chairs. So as opposed to being on your feet and walking back and forth, are you kind of at literally at the corner? What would that be? East First and Court? As opposed to walking back and forth?
Right. We are across East First. So we are on the river side of the street.
Oh, okay.
And so we're not on the police department property, okay. Which, you know, it makes a difference in terms of, you know, in terms of the relational temperature between the vigilers and the police department, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure there would be charges of loitering if we were on the police department, but we're there invisible, but not on property.
Yeah, I envisioned you at the foot of the steps, but being across the street west takes care of my next question, was that initially, did you need to make contact with someone at the police department to advise them of your plans for daily meetings at noon? But if you are across the street, maybe you don't need their, acceptance or permission.
Right. I was not on the sort of in the process quite that early. But I don't think that there was ever a permit requested, but I don't believe one is necessary. I know that we have been careful in making sure that folks involved know that, for instance, we have to leave enough room. There's a flood wall behind that sidewalk, and so we have to make sure we leave enough room between any of us who are gathered there and the flood wall for a motorized wheelchair to pass through. So we're not blocking the sidewalk.
Okay.
And so we're not interfering with any public right of way. And so I don't think that there is actually a need for a permit. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the sticking points between BLM and the police department last summer was around the question of whether they ought to apply for permits for their protests. And it's complicated when you're protesting against the police. It's complicated to make the case for, yes, you should also get a permit from the police to go protest against them. But I know the overall approach of BLM in Des Moines has not been to obtain permits.
This is probably a theoretical question, but how will you know or identify that you have made progress or that you have partially or completely accomplished some of your goals? What would that look like?
Oh, fantastic question. And as you well know, saying something's a fantastic question is something you say so you can stall for time. As a group, I think part of what we have been chewing on as kind of the clergy leaders, if you will, of this vigil is kind of that question of, okay, how do we know whether we are doing what we were here to do? Mm-hmm. And we're kind of supported there in really specifically by the folks from the Catholic Worker. So the Catholic Worker is a they are a movement that kind of the big things that they do are building community among those who are impoverished. So they operate hospitality to you know, people without homes and people without, you know, jobs that pay. And so really, and, you know, building community among those groups. The other thing that they do is protest. They've got this vibrant protest tradition. And really they do both of those things as ways of, as John said, witnessing that the kingdom of God is not here yet. And so the way that that the Catholic Worker folks talk about why are they continuing to protest against, you know, economic inequality and militarism and the ways, you know, the ways of the world that it's really easy to just kind of resign ourselves to. And really the reason that they're protesting is so that they don't resign themselves to it. So it's a really kind of protest as a spiritual discipline of saying, I'm not gonna accept the world as it is because the world is not yet as God intended it to be. And so they're really good when we start asking questions about, are we accomplishing anything? They're like, we're Catholic Workers. We never accomplish anything. But what we're doing is that we're, and what I'm doing is that I'm more than anything, I'm reminding myself that we're not there yet. And there's so much work to do that even just, you know, sort of, you know, letting BLM identify, here are the topics that we're really concerned about. And you can be concerned about their topics without even endorsing their solutions, right? You could say, hey, you know, enforcement of marijuana possession as a criminal offense is disproportionately very harmful to Black people in Des Moines and across the United States. And we could acknowledge that without even having to then say, and the solution is to legalize and decriminalize it. There could be other ways into that. But it keeps those questions at the front of our mind. And, you know, we're working on if there's an end goal here, right? The end goal is unwinding, you know, 402 years of anti-Black racism in the United States. And so what really does progress look like at that point, right? There's little incremental, hey, we have built some community around this thing, or we have taken some steps on this particular issue. You know, when the person who is working on starting a bakery brought down donuts and this was like, you know, middle of December, and she shows up with donuts and starts handing them out, and they're really good donuts. You know, but a piece of what I could tell was happening there was that we are in fact just cultivating some community, that folks know that they've got this group that they can identify with, in a way that leads them to want to feed each other. I don't know what that means in terms of, for instance, you know, at some point, do we get to declare victory and quit doing this? I don't know. I'm not sure. But the, you know, the what are we accomplishing question really feels to me more like the way that we would ask that question at church than the way that we ask that question in, you know, in politics. You know, in politics, you win if you get your bills across the finish line. And in church, man, we win when we are, you know, delighted to see each other and we know we're there for each other when things get tough. And that's more like what this group feels like.
Well, just a follow-up. I admire your discipline and your willingness to go whatever 11 months you've already been doing it and not become a little bit discouraged. But on the other side of the coin, the police know you guys are there. And like a lot of things we've talked about in this series, we don't always know who we have influenced or how we have impacted things. And you know, there's just no way of measuring that. But I would be the first one to say that your presence has probably helped the whole police department, top to bottom, maybe take a second thought about some of their actions. And like I say, we can't measure those. We won't have testimonials of what an officer maybe did differently because of your being there on an ongoing basis. But like I say, I'm just trying to picture me in your shoes. And I need feedback, good or bad. I need feedback that either we're not making any progress, we got to do something differently, or we are making progress and basically continue doing what we're doing. And that never, never land that you guys are, that you folks are experiencing personally would be tough for me. But like I say, I'll be the first one to admit that you folks have had influence. I wouldn't doubt that at all. And once again, you don't know how much things are maybe different in Des Moines, Iowa, the last 11 months because of your group being down there, as opposed to if they hadn't gone. So tip of my hat.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for identifying that, because it's, it is hard to, hard for us to identify, yes, we can tell we made this specific change. But to be able to say that, yeah, we have borne witness to this and perhaps have indicated to some of the folks who drive by, hey, maybe we should think about this differently, approach this differently. That would be helpful, yeah.
Maybe I should clarify why I was at the police station. One time I was at Drake writing a term paper on the drug problem in Des Moines. Now, this is in 1970. Another time I bailed out one of my employees at my convenience store because his father didn't have cash and he knew I did. And so I don't have an arrest record. I just wanted to have that asterisk.
So, as we mentioned last week, my kids have not left the house for the last 13 months. That's not strictly true, but they've been doing all of their school here, right? And so they know that I leave and go down to the police department every Monday at noon. And so they will joke, you know, oh, are you going down to get arrested? Every week. It just never gets old. I go down there every week. And but, you know, and it is, you notice too, as you know, if you've ever just, you know, been at the same place for long enough to kind of see the patterns of, you know, who's going by or what's going on. And, you know, so we recognize certain people who are out, you know, out for their noonday walk. And we recognize certain people who are, you know, driving to the police department because that's where they work. And we recognize people who are driving to the police department because they have business there. And as you watch that, you know, I'm not doing the statistics, but I can certainly anecdotally tell you what the preponderance relative to the background demographics of people of color and people with low economic status, who have much more business down there. And of course, as the sociologists have found, not because they're more criminal, but because they're more arrested. And so, you know, we see some of that as we're standing at that location too.
What did you think of the TED Talk and the possibility of applying a system to try to help police identify the issue and to do take some steps? I thought it was a very possibly scientific way to look at it, and a way that would enable police officers to look differently at what they're doing. Did you pick that TED Talk because you felt that that was a possibility of promoting dialogue and helping police officers look possibly differently at the way they're acting in situations?
Yeah, so I chose it, you know, partly so that it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't just be sort of, you know, my talking as though I were an expert, but to look at, you know, some of the, you know, this TED Talk was looking at some of the again, the structural issues that are behind this disproportionate impact of violence on the part of police toward communities of color, and so the things that really struck me about the talk were he said, if you want to manage behavior, then manage behavior. And so he defined, you know, he said, our job is not to make the police, you know, have better attitudes toward Black people. And he said, in fact, attitudes are a really poor predictor of behavior. But instead, change the behavior or change, you know, the things that are upstream of the behavior. So change the way that police are dispatched, or change the way that certain types of calls are answered, even if, you know, armed police officers are the ones who arrive. And by doing that and, you know, measuring those outcomes, then you're identifying, okay, what went into making this outcome change? And it's not, typically speaking, at a structural level, it's not you know, kind of a hearts and minds of the police officers situation. And these effects are independent of, you know, differences in criminality in, you know, different sections of town or whatever, that that, you know, sort of, you know, policing, police practices are a driver in these situations. There was actually, I try not to give you audio only things, but this same scholar was on Fresh Air, the NPR interview show a couple of months ago. I don't know, time blurs together. And so, you know, give a 5-minute interview on the same sets of questions and kind of what his work has been like in the, you know, 5 years or so since the TED talk. And he works directly with police departments, you know, and has to be invited in by the police department. But, you know, if he can get a police chief who says, hey, there are problems here, right? How can we work on this? And he says, okay, let's, you know, he's a social scientist. He says, let's operationalize this problem. Let's figure out, you know, not, oh, you know, why are people so mean, but rather what situations are we going into? How are we going into them? If I were to develop a hobby horse in the sort of the world of reducing violence police, probably the one that I would develop is mental health, mental illness specifically, because we call armed police officers to respond to people having psychotic breaks. We call armed police officers to respond to people who are in danger of hurting themselves. And then, shockingly, more often than we wish it would happen, those armed police officers who are called to prevent someone from hurting themselves hurt that person. Because we've called someone with a gun into a situation that was already volatile. What would happen if we had well-equipped, well-funded, adequately trained interventionists who could respond to mental illness crises who don't have the practice of always controlling the situation regardless of what the consequences are, but instead have the practice of how do we get this person into a safe environment? You know, even if that safe environment is, you know, for all intents and purposes, a padded room that where the temperature can come down and then we can go in and actually resolve the problems. But it is not a policing response traditionally practiced to clear everybody away from the person who's having the real crisis, let the crisis kind of burn itself out, and then we can respond to the person. The policing response as traditionally practiced is to neutralize the person as a threat. And even with the least force possible, if what you're trying to do is control that person as a threat, you're going to end up doing violence to that person. And so what if we just didn't, you know, what if we didn't make armed police officers our first call in the case of mental health crises?
Mm-hmm. Observation. We pay, and the pay isn't the point, but that's symbolic. We pay our law enforcement to enforce our ways of thinking. That's that at the point where society might be able to change, and I'm getting into utopian thinking, maybe we wouldn't need police officers either, at least armed ones. but we are paying them to enforce the kind of order that the ruling class wants. Also, since we were on the subject of the video, I didn't particularly like one aspect of it, maybe the major aspect. The fellow was talking about acting nice, not about being nice. That's the way it struck me. Now, I don't know how to make everybody be nice, but I thought it was kind of superficial.
And from a management standpoint, that's his point. So from a management standpoint, you know, and this is, you know, think of this at, you know, you go to Chick-fil-A, right? And you say thanks when they give you your order, and they say, what do they say? My pleasure, right? They are trained to say that. And they are trained to say that in order to accomplish a specific task. And their specific task is called emotional labor. Their job is to make you think that they're enjoying themselves, whether they are or not, right? The manager at Chick-fil-A does not care whether you are in fact enjoying yourself. The manager at Chick-fil-A cares whether you look like you're enjoying yourself. And the chief of police, let's say, does not honestly, you know, within certain broad boundaries, right, does not honestly care whether the people serving on the police force like the people that they are interacting with, but does care whether the people on the police force are behaving appropriately toward the people that they're interacting with. And part of the reason that makes a difference is, as Dr. Goff said in the TED Talk, attitude is actually a really poor predictor of behavior. So what I say I think and feel about the people in this community that I'm enforcing laws on and imposing order on, and that was what you were describing in the first part of your comment. Whatever I say I feel about those people, how I act is dependent on, yes, how I sort of carry myself into the situation, but also what situations I'm sent into and what my training tells me to do in those situations that I'm sent into. And so he says, boy, trying to figure out whether police officers have warm, fuzzy enough attitudes toward Black people in this country is a losing battle. Just trying to figure that out is a losing battle. But identifying, when does that interaction go wrong? What are the factors that lead that interaction to go wrong? And how do we mitigate those factors? How do we use these people? How do we use police officers in a way that actually makes the neighborhoods safer for people of color? And really his point from a management standpoint is that it does not matter from a management standpoint whether the person in the uniform thinks they like the person that they're interacting with. But what matters from a management standpoint is how that situation is structured. So there's, you know, there's good hearts and minds work to be done. Some of that hearts and minds work is really, you know, getting white folks like us to put our bodies in places where we can really understand, man, you know, I know what it's like to have to go bail somebody out of jail, right? That's a weird situation to be in. And I also know, so that was a heart piece, right? And the mind piece is that I know that there are parts of our community where people are much more likely to have to go bail their buddy out of jail or bail their son or daughter out of jail because of these other police interactions. And boy, maybe we should, you know, be legislating differently so that the police have a different kind of public order to enforce. But the hearts and minds work, the BLM folks are saying the hearts and minds work is on the legislative side. The, you know, it's not hearts and minds that are killing people. Pam.
Oh, I was just going to say, after I saw that video, I kept it on, went on to the next video with the same guy. And I almost like that one better. I mean, it struck me more because he was talking about white people that, for example, report a black woman running for Congress. She's going down the street and knocking on doors. And so they report her because they think she's, I don't know what they think she's going to do. Or, you know, report, you know, it just bugs me how people report stupid stuff to the police. I mean, that doesn't help the police either. So to me, some of the attitudes got to be a change of
public,
silly people that are calling in these stupid complaints. That it's just, it's crazy.
Right. Yeah. And so there is that, you know, that's a place where, those hearts and minds are actually a lot easier to do something with, because the police, when they get called in, they have to go respond.
Yeah.
And it would be great to give, you know, to give the police, again, something like that duty to de-escalate, right? But do you remember last year the woman in Central Park in New York who had her Cocker Spaniel off leash? And a black man who is a bird watcher was going down the same path and said, please, would you put your dog on leash? You know, next to the posted sign that says, keep your dog on leash. And she threatened to call the police on him.
Yes, that
time. Not because she thought he was committing a crime, but because, and this was, he recorded this, right? Cell phone video has completely revolutionized normal white people's access to what actually goes on here. But she was explicit that she would be calling the police on him as an act of violence. Mm-hmm. Because she knew that, you know, that the training that, you know, enforcing order is going to come in with violence on its hip. And that violence disproportionately goes poorly for people of color. And so she specifically, explicitly threatened him with that. Now, she committed a crime in so doing, right? And she also revealed something for the rest of us, that it is exactly as you said, Pam. You know, we as a society are calling the police on black people who are trying to figure out how to get their front door open.
Yeah.
That was, who was that? Henry Louis Gates, I believe. Was trying to get into his house and had lost his key or something like that, but it was his house, his name and address on his driver's license, and the police did not believe him. Right? And, you know, if you see somebody in your neighborhood trying to get into their house, you know, it is also possible to walk across the street and say, hey, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Right? So the situations into which we call the police.
Mm-hmm. There was also a case of a young black girl who was selling Kool-Aid on the corner, and a woman called the police on her because she didn't have a permit to sell Kool-Aid.
Right.
The family that I visited with this afternoon told me a story where their youngest son, who's 14, actually 16, just turned 16. Last year, he was walking home from school, just like he walked home from school every day. And a teacher called the police. And she said, when they asked her why she called the police, she said he looked like he was wandering. And he was a one house from the house he lived in. His mom was home in the house he lived in. And he was a tall black kid walking in a white neighborhood. And if you really thought a black, if you really thought any kid was walking and wandering in your neighborhood, wouldn't you open your door and just say, everything okay? Do you need some help? Before you call the police. It just doesn't make any sense.
I think that the issue is less that it makes less sense. It's how we are so exposed to being afraid of anybody who is different than we are. And we grow up that way. I'm not sure it's just Black people. If you see somebody that is seems out of place in your neighborhood, then that makes you afraid. I don't think somebody, Deb, I wish it was true, but I don't think somebody's going to lean out the door and say, is everything okay? They're going to lean out the door and close it and lock it and run in and call the police and say, somebody's in my neighborhood that shouldn't be here. And I don't know how you counter that. That's the big concern that I see, is how do we take the white people who get very defensive over systemic racism, where it's built in, where if you read some of the history, it's almost repeating itself. And that's the thing that's so frustrating. And some of the myth that comes out. I mean, I don't understand right now, for example, oh yes, let's cut all of the workman's comp to people. They're trying to get by, but oh no, they're not trying to work. They're not trying to find a job. And I don't understand the negativism. It makes me very unhappy, but I don't know how to combat it. And that is the issue that I find extremely frustrating.
Some of it is we're expecting the police to do a lot more than we should be expecting the police to do. So our initial reaction is, if you're unsure, if you're fearful, call the police. What about calling your neighbor and the two of you going out together to make sure the kid's okay? Or there's just so many other options, and we've moved away from that, and we're expecting the police to solve our every need, and yet they aren't capable of doing that. And they're just trying to control, so the violence goes with that.
The other thing is there's not as many people that even know their neighbors,
right,
anymore in a neighborhood. For example, when prior to everyone working and not being home, your kids, the people that you knew, you went to school, the kids went to school together, you got to know them when you would go and have PTA meetings, or you would go to ice cream social nights and et cetera. But anymore, I live on a very long street. I have to say that within the first half a dozen houses, yes, I know who people are. I won't say that I can tell you all their names. We just don't interact like we used to. So if there's somebody on my street that looks like they're out of place, I don't know who they are. So to call my neighbor and say that, no, the only person I'm going to call is somebody that I'm going to call the police and say there's somebody wandering around in my street. And I don't know who that is. I don't know if you're finding the same thing, but I just find we're all so self-contained anymore.
So there is a piece again of getting our bodies into uncomfortable places, and to have that sort of that physical experience of of having that conversation with someone who just happens to be, you know, down your street. You know, and that's long, slow, hard work. And it's not going to happen consistently for a lot of us, just as the, you know, the world is busy and complicated. And, as I've been sort of just recollecting, this last year or so, and, kind of making sense of my own place in this, and the way, among other things, that we call the police to handle our mental health problems because we don't call anyone else, right? And I'm actually remembering there was a when I was serving in my first church in northern Minnesota, there was a Native American guy who came to our church sometimes, and he had we had had several conversations and got to know him, and you know, he would sort of come and then leave and then come and then leave, as goes, especially with the particular mental illness that he had. And we had a lot of folks with mental illness at sort of in the orbit of the church that I served, which was a really great gift to me, actually, because it meant that I was getting this sort of this introduction to what mental illness is like through this congregation. And so there was some, you know, random afternoon that I think I was leaving the church and walking to my car or something like that, just parked right outside the church. And here comes this guy to just come up and have a conversation with me. I think he may have needed something, but it was one of those, I need something, but really what I need is just someone safe to talk to for a little while. And so we're just standing there talking. My church is right across the street from the county courthouse. And so there's a lot of police traffic just around my church building, as a matter of course. And before too long, pulls up on the street just at the end of our driveway, a Virginia Police Department car, and two officers get out and walk over and you know, kind of position themselves like here's me and here's the guy I'm talking to, and they just position themselves like here and here and start their own conversation with him, just to, you know, is everything okay, what's up, how do you, you know, and I can tell that they are trying to assess what's going on here, and they're doing it very calmly. I mean, this is one of the nice things about being in a small town, right? Every cop in town knows this guy, and has dealt with him at much worse moments than the one that we're having right now. But I've been reflecting a lot about the way that the, you know, first boots on the ground response to a fairly dark complected Ojibwe man and a white pastor who they probably didn't know I was a pastor, but standing in a church parking lot talking to each other, is to let's go over there and find out what's up. And so I've just been chewing on that a lot. And it kind of, you know, it goes kind of to what, you know, to what John is saying. We have sort of set up as the fundamental job of policing in the United States, which is to preserve sort of order, and specifically the order that white culture kind of demands. And I knew exactly where the mental health services were in the town that I was serving in. And I knew I could get him there if he needed it. And I could tell within 2 seconds he didn't need it, because I knew him, right? But yeah, the number of jobs that we have put on the police And the way that, because of all the other dynamics around policing, the way that some of those jobs are more dangerous when they're applied to some folks than to others. So just that question of, hey, there's somebody I don't know in my neighborhood, and I would kind of love for somebody to check that out. That's going to go differently, statistically speaking. That is going to go differently for that person if he looks like me than it will if it looks like Philip Atiba Goff, right? And he's smarter than I am. He's calmer than I am. He's less of a threat than I am. But it's going to go differently for him than it will for me. So there are all of those dynamics that are just, again, kind of built into the way that this works. And that's a piece of you know, what I'm praying to see transformed over time. But yeah, how do we deliver those services for folks?
Do most responses to requests for police involve two policemen? Do they routinely answer calls as a pair?
Ooh, okay, this is gonna fall under my first disclaimer, which is that I am not an expert on policing. Anecdotally, I typically see, when I see a regular traffic stop, I often see another officer pull in behind that first one.
Oh.
And, you know, we used to kind of joke, we lived on a fairly busy street when we lived up in northern Minnesota. And you know, this was a town of 9,000 people. And, you know, so there were probably three cops on duty at any given time. And we used to joke that from anywhere in town, all three cops would go to any event. And we could see them go by. So, you know, I think I would anticipate, if I were just trying to think of how would I deliver the service of being in control of a situation, if that's the service I'm delivering, then yeah, I probably want backup everywhere I go. Is that overall safe for the community? I'm not an expert on policing.
When we call, when we've had to call the police for Matt, two police officers show up. When I call the police, I tell them that it's a mental health issue, whether he has a weapon, what our worry is, and ask them that, and tell them that he has paranoid schizophrenia. Please, if they can, turn their lights and sirens off, and that will keep him calmer. And they do that. They also call the crisis team. But Des Moines and the entire metro has one crisis team. So the police have to stay with you until the crisis team gets there. And it can be 3 hours. And you've called the police, so there's no turning back. You can't say, you know, I don't think we need to. You sit there with them for 3 hours with a very paranoid, mentally ill young man waiting for the social worker to show up with the crisis team. And when I asked, you know, how many teams were there after waiting for 3 hours the first time we'd had to do this, I was shocked to find out that it was the Des Moines Metro, Des Moines and the Metro has one team. So that team is fantastic. And that's not
one team on at any given time. That is one team during business hours.
Right. And they're fantastic. The training that they have, their ability to calm the situation down, to figure out what the next step needs to be to get them to a hospital, has been unbelievably remarkable in our two times of doing this. But we need more of that. And that you could call the crisis team yourself instead of calling the police would be another step forward. But that's not a possibility right now. You have to go through the police to get to the crisis team. So, and maybe that'll change with everything that's happening right now, but most of the upheaval and the discussion and the protests is not about the mentally ill. it's about Black Lives Mattering and Black liberation. So we're not even touching the mental health part of it right now.
Very true.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.